Hello and welcome back to Celluloid Jelly, a podcast featuring a couple of ex-video store guys who still just love talking about movies. I'm CJ Talbot. Joining me as always will be Cesar Alejandro Jr. from Filmsmash.com. For this episode, we're discussing Howard Hawks' Only Angels Have Wings from 1939.
All right. Hey, Cesar, how we doing?
Good, CJ. How about you, man?
I'm doing good. Doing very well. I'm excited to talk about this movie because we haven't seen it. Neither of us have seen it.
Yeah.
Well, we have seen it now.
Yeah.
Because we're going to talk about it, but we had not seen it. I think, is that the first time that's happened in our podcast history where we picked a movie that neither of us have seen?
I'd probably have to go through and take a look, but I feel like, you know, certainly in our previous iteration of our podcast, we talked a lot more about first run films. So a lot of times we hadn't seen those films before we discussed them. I might have to take a look at the list for this current one, see what's up with that though.
I think it might be though. So I'm happy that you chose this movie. So that's awesome.
I'm happy I chose this movie too. Also for a different reason.
Well, hopefully we'll get into those reasons.
Okay.
You mentioned earlier that you had seen Annihilation, that you wanted to delve into that a little bit.
I don't know if I need to delve into it, but I figure it was going to come up in discussion. Being a pretty recent film and somewhat of a wide release.
Well, I really enjoyed Alex Garland's previous movie, Ex Machina. So if the listeners out there have not seen Ex Machina, they should definitely check that out. That movie is terrific.
Yeah, I am a huge fan of that movie.
Yeah, we did check out Annihilation. I saw it after you. You saw it Thursday night, right?
Opening, yeah. I guess it was after our previous recording.
So yeah, I think I saw it that following Sunday or Monday. So just a few days ago.
Okay. Gut reaction.
I really enjoyed it. I'm a fan of science fiction, as most people know. Especially the more challenging, cerebral science fiction movies that don't always get put into a nice, neat box like adventure or something like that. I thought the cast was good. I don't know if you want to get into spoilers for that because it's not a huge movie like a Black Panther where everybody rushed out to see it the first week. A lot of people may be seeing this on Netflix shortly because Paramount sold the rights, so it's actually gonna probably leave theaters. I think the Netflix debut is March 12th.
March 12th in the United States.
I've seen that date floated around, so. I'm sure if it's doing well in theaters, they'll keep it in theaters, but I'm not sure it's going to last 3 or 4 weeks in theaters, so.
I thought that, like, the March 12th date was just a UK release or the other Netflix territories, but I could be mistaken.
You might be right. I'm not sure, but regardless, you know, it's going to end up getting trounced on by some of the larger movies that are coming out, and of course
it's been trounced by smaller movies too.
Yeah, well, and Black Panther is still doing tremendous business, so. But anyway, getting back to Annihilation, so what did you think?
I think barring some very suspenseful moments in the film, overall it didn't work for me very much at all.
Okay.
I think there's a blandness to a lot of the acting in this film, despite having a couple actresses that I tend to be fans of, like Tessa Thompson, Jennifer Jason Leigh, and Natalie Portman, who I like, even though I never really thought, aside from like Black Swan, maybe, I've never really thought that she was that great of an actress. She's very likable, certainly, in a lot of her other roles. But
did you miss Jackie? Did you miss Jackie?
I did not see that.
No. Oh, yeah. Okay.
Well, I'm only going from my experience.
No, okay. So. Yeah, no, I asked because that's another one of her Oscar-nominated performances. And she's quite good in that as well.
I definitely don't think that this, like this movie probably, showcased her talents. I don't really buy her as a, you know, either a biologist or a military soldier. Cause that's who she plays in this film. Yeah.
You don't think that she has sort of a natural intelligence to her?
No, well, I mean, I think she's there for a couple, she's there in the events of this movie for a couple different reasons, which, you know, we said no spoilers, but there are things that she does where, you know, she says she's a biologist, but, I mean, everything that she finds, you can tell visually through the audience, so, like, there's never any kind of, like, importance for her being a scientist there, necessarily, aside from, you know, having a microscope in one scene.
Yeah, well, I think aside from the idea that she is a biologist by trade, I think she, you know, they establish pretty quickly that she's not been invited because of being a biologist. She's been in, you know, she's been taken there because she's been exposed to something because of events that happened earlier in the film, and she has a personal connection to someone who's been missing, so that's why she becomes a part of the team.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, it's except, like, when her inclusion is there, while it's not fully understood why she's been on the team, you know, her credentials are Hopkins, an instructor at Johns Hopkins.
Right.
I just, you know, maybe I'm just tainting my perception of her based on her other performances. I thought it was believable. I think there's a certain malaise that exists in most of the actresses in this movie, unfortunately. I think Jennifer Jason Leigh is an example where she's very, I think bland's the right word. She seems, like, lethargic in the movie.
I can see that. I can. To be honest, I think I would agree with you to a point that there's not a lot of challenging material for the actresses in the film. It's nice that there's a cast of four great actresses who are the leads in this movie, and it's in one of the shortcomings of the film is probably not giving them enough. You know, there are a couple of scenes of excitement, and there's one tense conflict that happens between them in the second half of the film.
I'm sure we're talking about the same sequence, that tense scene. I thought that scene was pretty good.
Yeah.
Pretty damn good. I do have some issues with some of the CG, but I think a lot of CG these days, for some reason, doesn't look as good to my eyes as it used to.
Does it has something to do with the bear?
Yes.
Okay. All right.
But I do think, like, the physical stuff, like the makeup effects and the set design, the ones that are, like, more tangible, I thought that stuff was quite good. The ending of the film doesn't really work for me for a number of different reasons, primarily in comparison to how well that type of ending is done in a lot of other films. And, you know, I think it doesn't convince me that the movie is doing anything special at all.
Okay.
Maybe that's a little harsh, but...
I'll tell you, it did remind me of a science fiction movie that came out a few years ago that I did not care for very much, but, like, structurally, it felt a lot like The Signal.
Is that the one with Nicole Kidman?
No, Larry Fishburne is, like, the scientist in it, and I can't remember who the kid is.
I wonder what movie I'm thinking about with Nicole Kidman.
I don't think she's in it. I don't remember her being in it. I just remember the entire thing being framed by the idea that this kid was in and out of this particular place, and the film was framed with, like, an interview of what was happening. And so there were some similar aspects as far as being, like, contagion-related, or at least that they were worried about contagion. You know, so you've got the... I can't remember... What's the actor's name who was in... Doctor Strange, that's also in Annihilation.
Benedict Wong.
Yeah. So his character, you know, is interviewing Natalie Portman in a containment suit, essentially.
Yeah.
You know. Yeah. So anyway, we can move on. I enjoyed it. I think people who enjoy science fiction certainly will find something in this. You know, I'm sorry to hear that you didn't like it that much, but.
Well, you know, like I think, just like you, you know, I tend to quite enjoy like a high concept science fiction film. I just think that it just didn't work for me. You know, I seem to definitely be in the minority when it comes to some of the opinions I'm hearing about this film, just around like other film circles. I mean, what can I say that didn't speak?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, for me, I really enjoyed the way it unfolded as far as the concept and the idea of what do they call it in the movie? The glimmer?
The shimmer.
Shimmer. What the shimmer actually is and how it affects them and how that ultimately gets resolved at their you know, their goal point, their end point, where they're going, you know, I quite enjoyed, so.
Okay, that's fair enough.
Acceptable. Yes.
Have you watched anything else besides that since the last time we recorded? Anything you want to address?
No, I don't think so. I think I mentioned on our last episode that I was rewatching the Thin Man movies. You know, watched a couple more of those. And, you know, aside from this one, just the couple at the theater, we saw Game Night and Annihilation over the weekend. Game Night was also, I thought, pretty darn good. Very funny. Some stylistic touches that I really enjoyed, which you don't always get a lot of great directorial flourishes in comedies. And I think that there's a couple things in Game Night that I really liked. Jason Bateman and Rachel McAdams are very funny.
Who directs Game Night?
It was the duo behind the Terrible Vacation reboot. John Francis Daly and I can't remember the other guy's name. Michael something, I think.
Well, I've always heard that a lot of people enjoy that film, though.
I think there are things in it that I enjoy, especially Chris Hemsworth's performance in Vacation. But I thought the rest of the movie was pretty bad. But they also wrote Spider-Man Homecoming, which was pretty good. And so they directed Game Night. So it's got a good cast. I like the concept. You know, it's not something we haven't seen before, but you know, it's basically like a riff on like David Fincher's The Game as a comedy. And Kyle Chandler as Jason Bateman's older brother, I thought was terrific. So,
yeah, I do like Kyle Chandler.
Yeah,
I think we delved on that just a little bit last week.
Well, I don't know if we mentioned it last week or not, but because we were talking about Sky Captain, his performance, Kyle Chandler's performance in Peter Jackson's King Kong, is a very like awesome like throwback like 1930s performance.
Well, that's who he's trying to portray.
Right, exactly. He does it well.
Yeah, okay.
What about you? Anything else you want to talk about?
I guess a couple days ago, I was finally able to track down a decently priced DVD copy of a Japanese film I was a fan of I was unable to own for a very long time. The movie's called The Flavor of Happiness. It's another one of those cuisine, gourmet-style films.
I know you love your food movies.
Oh, man, do I. Well, this film, basically, it's about... There's a woman played by Miki Nakatani, who I guess Japanese filmmakers will know. She's very prolific for such a young actress. And she plays an employee at a department store who has a new food area being installed in like their building. So she goes to a Chinese restaurant that's owned by the actor Tatsuya Fuji, playing a Chinese man named Mr. Wong. and she's trying to convince him to produce food for their department store. Now, at first, he gives her the brush off. He is not interested. As she goes there continuously to kind of try to convince him, she always orders some food to go along with it, gradually falling in love with his food. Her father was a former chef, so she kind of begins to see him as almost like a surrogate father. And when he suffers a medical calamity, the restaurant goes under danger. She decides to quit her job and become his apprentice in order to kind of keep the restaurant going. Generally, that's a premise that you could kind of turn in into a comedy very easily. You know, underdog stories tend to lend themselves that kind of easy plot point. But the movie itself is quite a tender, really warm-hearted movie, and one I love immensely. So I think the DVD I got, I probably ordered a couple weeks ago, but it finally arrived this past week, and you know, I probably sat down and watched it like immediately that evening, and then I rewatched like the cooking scenes a couple of times since then.
That's really funny. I think you told me once though that you, because I know you love to eat, but you don't love to cook. Is that still the case?
Yeah, that's pretty much the case.
Okay.
I mean, I can prepare stuff, but it's, you know, I think leave it to professionals is what I'm saying.
All right, I gotcha. That's fine. Yeah, I like to have others prepare my meal also, but like for someone who is so like. I love to eat, but like you seem to have like a much deeper appreciation for the art of like creating great food. Like I just think it's funny that you don't like to cook yourself. I think it's
well, you know, I wouldn't say like I dislike cooking. It's just there's a preference there. So I'm not adverse, and I wouldn't say I'm like incompetent in the kitchen or anything, but you know.
Hang on. I wasn't saying that either.
I know. Situation arise, I'm sure I can pull something out of that.
Cesar doesn't know a fork from a spoon, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah, use chopsticks, everyone. But, yeah, I guess, you know, that's something I always wanted. You know, who doesn't want to become, you know, a good cook? Sometimes it's just not in the cards for everyone. You know, I'm fine with just being an average cook.
It takes a lot of time, too.
Yeah, certainly.
Yeah.
There's too many movies out there. How can I learn cooking?
There you go. Hey, nice point. Yeah, nice point.
I'm doing this for you listeners out there.
Look, I'm eating greasy takeout so that I can watch more movies so that I can be informed for you guys.
I can make a bowl of mini wheats like no one's business, though.
Sweet. I prefer oatmeal. Frosted mini wheats are good, though. We do have that in common, so...
Yeah, so, I mean, yeah, I really recommend it. I mean, I wrote a review on the site, like, years ago. Yeah, it was nice for me to revisit it. Lovely film.
Awesome. It sounds really good and intriguing, so you have to let me borrow it one day.
Sure. I mean, it's a region 3 disc, though, so let me know when you get some all-region capability.
You got it. Just keep a running tally. Just, like, once I get an all-region player, just ship me, like, a crate full of DVDs.
I have plenty of stuff to suggest.
Okay, good. All right, awesome.
Swing Girls.
I've seen that.
Yeah. I loaned the Blu-ray to you, and now I can't find a Blu-ray, so I'm pretty upset.
Wait, I definitely gave that back to you.
You definitely did.
Okay. I was going to say.
But I do have a DVD of it as well, but that's a region 3. So, I mean, that's a placeholder, but... It's not 1080p.
Well, that Swing Girls was really good. What was the other movie that you made me watch that was about like it was about a family, and I think they were grieving, but there was food involved.
The Godfather?
No, it was an Asian cinema title.
I don't know, what was the movie about?
I don't remember. It was like a like an older sister, like, taking over the family because the father was sick or something like that?
Wait, are you talking about Eat, Drink, Man, Woman?
No. Definitely not.
No? Okay. Taking something over because the father was sick.
I don't remember. I'll have to look it up.
Did I loan it to you?
Yeah.
Like a disc?
Yeah.
I don't know.
It was probably 3 years ago.
I don't know.
It was part of the old podcast.
Yeah. Okay. So well, that was actually something we discussed on an episode?
Yeah.
As an episode? What?
Not as a whole episode. Remember we used to trade DVDs and I would make you watch something and you'd make me watch something?
Oh, yeah.
That's how you saw Take Me Home Tonight. You're welcome.
No, I mean, I think you suggested it to me because I own a copy of that movie. You didn't loan that to me.
Maybe, but we watched it because I wanted to watch it for the podcast.
Okay.
So I'm taking credit for that. I also made you watch The Best of Times, right?
No, we never got to that.
Oh.
I've seen that movie before, though.
Yeah, I love that fucking movie. Kurt Russell and Robin Williams are amazing in that.
A possible upcoming episode, folks.
All right, well, let's move forward to Howard Hawks' Only Angels Have Wings from 1939. Okay. This was your pick for this episode, so again, thank you for that. Do you want to describe it? What's Only Angels Have Wings about?
Okay, Only Angels Have Wings stars Cary Grant, Jean Arthur, Rita Hayworth in a very early role, and a couple supporting actors, Thomas Mitchell, Richard Barlmoose. The movie stars Cary Grant as Jeff Carter. He plays a manager / pilot of the small charter airline service somewhere in South America. And basically, their job is to transport stuff over the Andes Mountains. While they're there, the movie takes place over the span of about a week, but he meets a very important week in the airline's business operations because they're at the tail end of an agreement that could potentially get them a lucrative government contract delivering mail. In this week, you find him being, maybe not the set's the right word, but he meets, you know, a young woman played by Jean Arthur who is seemingly enamored of him. He meets with a couple of mishaps with his airline in terms of dangerous situation with his pilots and a couple other situations, you know, on the road to getting this government contract. And I guess that's pretty much it. I don't know. Is there something else you want to add, or did I cover that?
No, already? I think it's interesting because this is not a traditional like 3-act movie.
Yes.
It's much more episodic than that. So I think you hit a lot of the main points there. But yeah, it's, you know, Rita Hayworth is his old flame. She comes back into his life while he's developing a romance with Jean Arthur. Rita Hayworth's new husband is a new pilot for his airline who has a history with Cary Grant's best friend / employee, you know, whose character's name is just the kid. So there's a lot of stuff going on as far as like their interpersonal relationships and stuff. I gotta be honest, as I usually do, I watch this movie twice. The first time I watched it, I thought it was okay. I didn't love it. To be honest, I wasn't 100% sure what to expect since I hadn't seen it before. I was a little surprised that I hadn't seen it because, you know, of all the people involved, and I love Cary Grant, and I like Jean Arthur. I've seen her in a bunch of other movies, notably Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, of course. You know, I like Rita Hayworth, and, you know, I've seen Thomas Mitchell in some other Frank Capra movies as well, so I really like him. So I was a little, not let down, but, you know, it was just okay, I thought. But going back and watching it a second time, I'm not sure why, but, like, I had a much better time with it the second time.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and and not just an appreciation for the film craft and things like that, but I actually, like, I just kind of felt like scenes had more emotional punch the second time for me.
Yeah, just, you know, just knowing their destiny, I guess, huh?
Maybe. I mean, I don't know. I don't think I wasn't paying attention the first time or anything like that. I mean, you know, I definitely was. But the second time, it just, I don't know. You know how some movies just click for you on a particular viewing, and I think...
Yeah, I think, I mean, there's a lot of films that I probably watched as a kid that don't have that, that never resonated with me until I was, you know, an adult. I mean, that's something like a longer stretch that just, you know, a second viewing a few days later.
Yeah.
I know what you mean.
Yeah. So I enjoyed it. You know, I mean, first of all, I guess, you know, I did, as I usually do, I kind of, like, you know, went to Wikipedia and IMBD and IMDb, not BD.
Yeah.
I'm sitting here in my BBDs, but that's a different story.
Okay.
But, you know, so I have, you know, I have a few production notes here, unrelated to my underwear. Barranca, which is where the South American port town near the Andes Mountains where this takes place, is actually a fictional town. It's just a made up thing. And a lot of this movie, was actually based on a story that Howard Hawks wrote. The screenplay is actually credited to Jules Furthman. And it was based on a script called Plane Number 4, which was written by Anne Wigton. And then Hawks rewrote it based on his own story called Plane from Barranca, which pulled a lot from his personal experience when he was a flyer himself. And then throughout the production process, two other writers, Eleanor Griffin and William Rankin, came on board and helped out. Actually, while they were shooting, they were rewriting as well, which is not common. Are not uncommon then, and certainly not uncommon now. A lot of the stuff in this movie, you know, obviously, spoiler warning, kid's death is based on a real event that Hawks was, that he had witnessed himself. And the relationship between Cary Grant's character and Gene Arthur's character is based on a couple that he met while he was actually scouting locations for a different movie a few years before this called Viva Villa. So a lot of this is based on Hawks' personal experience. Bam. Period. The end.
Is it my turn?
Yeah, go for it.
Okay, well, basically, I really, really enjoyed this film immensely. I think this probably... You mentioned that it's kind of episodic, not necessarily a traditional three-act. I thought, like, the first 20 minutes... I guess, generally, this is the case for a lot of films from this era, though, but things happen, like, immensely, like, blisteringly fast. You know, things move multiple scenes... Like, in 5 minutes, you'll have multiple scenes, snappy dialogue. And the film kind of goes to a lot of different places. The first 20 minutes introduces characters... demonstrates some pretty extreme tension. I guess, like, you have that first crash between featuring Joe the pilot, Noah Beery Jr. in a very short role. I thought, like, the opening sequence was very, very suspenseful. And I guess the final sequence where you mentioned, you know, of course, the final crash at the end of the film. The movie itself... I thought was really compelling. I really enjoyed, like, kind of like the fraternity that the pilots have with each other. And, I guess, like, the relationship that they have, you know, it's kind of almost like a really kind of like hard professionalism that they take. But there's also, I imagine, stories that I've heard about pilots going out, like, say, like in World War I, maybe drinking or such, you know, before going on a mission. So there's that camaraderie that exists there, which I thought was very compelling to me, even with, you know, a character like McPherson, a.k.a. Kilgallen, who doesn't necessarily have that that afforded to him, at least initially.
Yeah. And, man, Richard Bart, I'm a little fuzzy on how to pronounce his last name. Barthelmess? Is that it?
I don't know. I said Barthelmess, but I don't know if that's correct.
He was a very famous silent film actor, and
he's got expressive eyes, definitely.
But he's got the kind of eyes where, like, the whites of his eyes seem like they're so big. So, like his pupils look really small. So, like, I don't know. It's an unusual, like, look and an effect that you know, when the light goes into his eyes. But he has a face that looks like it's carved out of granite. And that's because he had apparently plastic surgery that went awry, and he had an infection, and it caused these deep scars underneath his eye tissues. And so he usually would wear very heavy makeup in his movies to cover it up. And when Howard Hawks cast him in the movie, he said, "Look, we're not gonna cover up your scars. You know, I think it will add something to your character." Something else interesting that he did for that particular actor, who is not a very tall person, normally he would put somebody like that on apple boxes or planks to make them appear a little bit taller, to get them up to the same level, an eye line, as the other actors. And in this case, he didn't do that because he wanted it to reflect the character's inferiority among his fellow pilots, which I thought was cool.
Yeah, Cary Grant, he's pretty statuesque too, you know, so.
Well, not just with Grant, but with the other guys too, but yeah, I mean, well, speaking of Grant, and I don't know how you feel about this, I love Cary Grant. He does seem like he's a little miscast in this movie. Like, all the other actors around him have sort of like a blue-collar authenticity to them, and he seems a little too out of place, like he, you know, because
like
of...
Like his word use and
yeah,
like
because of the sophistication that he carries himself and his posture. He's never been a terribly physical actor in that regard. And, you know, he's got that really kind of made-up Philadelphia accent that didn't ever really exist, but, like, a lot of Hollywood stars sort of, like, learn to speak in a different way, like Katharine Hepburn's another one. So they always talked like this, and they would deliver lines like this so that you would know that they were upper crust. And that really doesn't...
That's terrific, everyone.
Thank you.
Those last 5 seconds, immensely.
Make that your ringtone. And that, I don't know, to me that kind of felt a little bit out of place in this movie. However, As the movie wears on, it becomes less of an issue. But like when he's introduced, everything that happens up to the point where Cary Grant comes in feels exotic and vibrant, and like it feels like the world is very well established. And then he comes in, he's got this ridiculous like white sombrero, and his clothes are all clean, and he just looks so different than everybody else. Everybody else's clothes are like rumpled, and they have like dirt on their face, and you get the sense that they all have dirt under their fingernails, and he just is nothing like that. And he just sticks out like a sore thumb. do you agree?
Well, I think you're right. Like maybe initially, like it's like that hat though is really distracting. Like,
the first time he shows thankfully, up. He ditches that after like 4 scenes.
Yeah. Hopefully, he caught on fire. but yeah, I think you know, one of the things this character does, is, you know, he smokes cigarettes a lot. But you're right about the way he carries himself. He's definitely the type of character I would have imagined smoking a pipe as opposed to a cigarette. You know.
Yeah.
That's not to say that the film has like a dirty grittiness to it, like say like a spaghetti western or anything of that sort. But yeah, Cary Grant definitely seems quite a bit more like polished in terms of upkeep compared to like way more so than anyone else.
Yeah,
you know, he's shaven. You know, his hair is always like perfectly like, you know, slicked back. Yeah.
Well, there is. They do a good job in certain scenes, like the scene. After Joe dies, And you have that initial big scene where they crash, and then everybody, the aftermath of Joe's death, when Jean Arthur gets really upset. And I actually really love that stretch of the movie, especially the interplay between Jean Arthur and Cary Grant. When she realizes what's happening and that they all just can't acknowledge the danger that they face every day by mourning the loss of Joe, you know, and she comes back into the room and everything settles down. It's the end of the night. And the guy, I can't remember the character's name, but the guy brings in like the last of what they found on Joe's body, like his wristwatch and some other stuff.
Yeah.
And Jean Arthur walks up to the bar and Cary Grant tells her to go ahead and take something. And she's like, no, I couldn't possibly. And he's like, you know, go ahead, you know, souvenir, you know, what else are we going to do with this stuff? And she picks up, it looks like it's a, it doesn't look like it's a watch. It looks like it's a bracelet. And Cary Grant sort of like smiles knowingly that that's maybe like the most valuable thing in the pile. And he says, you've got a good eye, sister, I think, or something like that. And she gives him a look that like speaks volumes as to the type of disgust and disappointment that she has in his character at that point. And she walks over and gives it to the native girl that was sweet on Joe. And then when she comes back, like for a different director, like this is what makes Hawks so great. Like for a different director, that would have been the end of it. But when she comes back, she stares him in the eye and again with disgust, like shakes her head almost in like a, like the way a mother would do, you know, to a child, you know? And like, I really, really, really love that moment.
Yeah, that's a pretty memorable scene. And I mean, I think, you know, the movie tends to have Cary Grant being pretty aloof, especially towards her character. That moment, though, I guess you can kind of tie like the reactions and interactions between them all the way back to that kind of. I wouldn't say like it totally controls him because he stays pretty much in character and in tone for the rest of the film. But that definitely kind of changes the way he perceives his relationship with her.
Yeah, definitely.
He definitely kind of changed him. You know, even if it's just a little bit, but it was enough to make a difference, especially by the end of the film. So
yeah, well, she becomes much more attractive because she's not just a pretty face, and I like the idea that like Rita Hayworth comes into the picture and she's his ex, and he has to sort of get over the idea that he's been sort of burned. So like he ultimately rejects Jean Arthur initially. Like he has this rapport with her that's like, okay, you know, like you're going to be gone at 4 a.m. anyway. So I might as well give this a shot. And they get to the point where they're going to go up to his room together, obviously for a little bounce. Wow. Wow. and as they're walking to the door, he sort of realizes that it isn't a good idea, and he tries to, he's like, follow your nose, you'll get to your boat. And then he's going to go up in the plane. So when he comes back, she makes the decision that she's not going to go back on the boat, and she's still there. That wasn't something that entered into his mind at all, I don't think. And so when she's still there, then he's threatened, because he is attracted to her and he does like her and he knows she's not the typical woman that he would see there. And that's why he just flatly rejects her at that point, I think.
Yeah. He's certainly not ready. He gives that speech earlier on. He doesn't want to ask a woman, doesn't want to ask anything of a woman.
Right.
But, you know, he's definitely, you know, that expectation of, you know, his kind of like flittering through life kind of like is maybe at risk when like, you know, she kind of throws a wrench in like, you know, the revolving door scenery.
Right. And in in true Hollywood fashion, not only her throwing a wrench into it, but Rita Hayworth coming back into his life at the same time.
You know, to be honest, though, I never really felt that, like, Rita Hayworth, her character, ever really put that much of a challenge to Jeff. You know, Jeff seems to kind of carry on. You know, it's unexpected, certainly. You know, but he seems like no trouble hiding, like, their past relationship, as well as, you know, being fully accepting of it, like, something that he accepted years ago, and this happens to be, it's just a blast from the past, but doesn't really threaten his current life.
Well, and this might have something to do with the Hollywood code. You're absolutely right. But I think the idea that that she's now married to another flyer, that she's not going to be, like, a threat to Bon, or is it, it's Bonnie, right? Bonnie Lee?
Yeah.
So the Jean Arthur character. If she wasn't married and she was just in a relationship with this other guy, I think they would have played that as more of, like, a romantic interest for him and a love triangle. But I think they downplay the Rita Hayworth specifically because she's married. And that might just be a thing with the Hollywood code at the time. I don't know.
Okay. Yeah, I'm certainly not as well-versed in, like, the little nuances of how that affected a lot of films from that period. I'm going to defer to you on that.
Well, I'm certainly no expert, but, that makes sense to me. I know they controlled a lot of things, and I think, there weren't a ton of movies that dealt with adultery, unless they were sort of, like, darker crime movies. So, it could have been a studio choice, it could have been Hawks' choice, it could have just been that they were focusing on other things, but it could have also been part of the code, I don't know.
Yeah, okay. That's something that'd be kind of interesting to, delve on after the recording.
Yeah. And I don't know if it was audible or not, but for some reason my computer's fan kicked on for, like, the last 5 minutes, so sorry about that.
I'm not hearing on my end. I guess in the end it only really depends on, whether the recording picked it up.
Yeah.
But I didn't catch any of that. So, anything else?
No, well, we talked about Cary Grant, but I said that I felt like he was miscast. I do think he's pretty good in the movie, though. It's not my favorite Cary Grant performance, but I think he's, especially in the second half of the movie, I think he's quite good. In particular, I think in his scenes with the kid, with Thomas Mitchell.
Yeah, I think one of my favorite scenes in general is that kind of long take where he's
testing his eye vision.
Yeah, testing eye vision. Well, it's not fully a long take, that whole scene, but, like, there's a point where that scene starts, like, kind of like after the after he does, like, I guess, an eye test for lighting up sights.
Yeah.
Or something. I thought their rapport, I think, is very good. So like, their friendship, I think, especially, like, with Kid, spoiler, of course, that Kid dies at the end, really, really means something and affects them because of how close they are.
So absolutely.
You can say in film that, they're best friends, but, like, I think that scene really shows it.
I think you can get a sense of their rapport throughout the picture. I think in the scene before Joe crashes, when they're trying to talk Joe in at the beginning of the film, Kid just sort of, like, they don't really introduce him into the movie. He just sort of walks in and becomes part of the scene. But when they're leaving to go out to the field, he grabs Cary Grant's jacket, and Cary Grant starts talking on the microphone, and he just puts the jacket around his shoulders and said, "Hey, it's going to be cold out here, Pop." And then as they're trying to talk Joe in, they're both kind of figuring out where the plane is and what direction and where he's coming from and where he needs to go. And he just has they have a rapport and a chemistry that Grant really doesn't have with anybody else, or at least with any of the other male characters in the film. That scene that you're talking about earlier, where he has to ground Kid which is maybe like the toughest thing you can tell a friend is, look, I know you love this, but you can't do it anymore because you're not capable. That's a tough thing to do for anybody. And I think they do a great job with it. I think Grant and Mitchell are both really good in that scene. And I love that Mitchell, when Grant's like, look, you can be of help to us in other ways. And Mitchell says, and I didn't write the quote down, but he says, yeah, I can help out the mechanic with this. And then there's a pause and he hesitates, and it really sets in that he's not going to fly anymore and that he's really not going to be of that much use. And he just pauses and says, sure, and walks out the door. And I really found that to be an emotional moment. And then they punctuate that scene
with the chair check.
Yeah, with Grant kicking the chair over, which is the most emotion we've seen from that character the entire movie, really, up until that point. So like that's a, you know, a candidate at least for one of my favorite scenes of the movie.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's my favorite scene of the film, probably.
Yeah, it's a great one.
Super, super memorable. You know, it, I also like, I guess like the scene, I guess Cary Grant comes back after work and Gene Arthur is in his room taking a shower.
Yeah.
So it tends to be a little bit more of a, lends itself more towards kind of like a screwball comedy.
Absolutely.
In that scene. So I think it's very interesting how Howard Hawks is always able to kind of genre bend in a lot of his movies. That scene's pretty good too. Of course you get, that scene is meant to kind of put, Bonnie, Jean Arthur's character's like a heart at ease.
Right.
Because previously she considered Rita Hayworth's character, Judy, as kind of like competition, for a couple of things, you know, including her eavesdropping and spying earlier in the film, you know, kind of.
Right. I love the end of that scene when Jean Arthur accidentally like walks into the door frame before she leaves, which is hilarious.
Into the door frame and into the branch.
Right.
I was like, good physical acting right there, really.
She's got great comic timing. She's really good.
Absolutely.
Yeah, one other thing about Arthur, when Hawks cast her, he was sort of looking for a different kind of take on that character. And he was looking for more of that, like, sultry quality. And he tried to direct her to play it in a more sexy way. And she resisted him. I read sort of an excerpt from an interview where Gene Arthur just flatly said, I can't do that kind of stuff. And at the end of the movie, Howard Hawks apparently told her, you're one of the few people I've ever worked with that I don't think I've helped out at all. Someday you can go see what I wanted to do, because I'm going to do this character all over again in a different movie. And apparently years later, after To Have and To Have Not came out with Bogart and Bacall, Hawks came home one night and Gene Arthur was in his driveway. And she said, I wish I had done what you asked me to do. If you ever make another picture with me, I'll promise to do any goddamn thing you want me to do. If a kid can come in and do that kind of stuff, I certainly can do it. But they never worked together again.
You know, to be honest, though, I like her choice in this film, though.
No, I do, too. Yeah, actually, I don't see... If you replace Gene Arthur with a Lauren Bacall type, I don't think it works nearly as much because she's way too much like Rita Hayworth then.
I think one of the things I do like is how, she comes into the town. She's so kind of like cocksure. She's, but like as she becomes, her same thing with like her clothing, you know, she starts wearing more casual clothing the longer she's there. So she's kind of like, ingratiating herself into like this community, this kind of like transitive community where, you know, people are coming and going continuously. With her being out of her element at the beginning and her slowly becoming more comfortable, I think that's a good arc for her character, definitely.
I agree, and I like the fact that she's a little bit more comedic than that type of a character usually would be if it had been a different actress. I like especially the way that in the finale, the way they end the relationship with Jeff and Bonnie by basically, you know, like she says, I need you to tell me, you know, obviously I'm paraphrasing, but I need you to tell me that you want me to stay. And he's like, well, you know, I'll flip a coin. And it's the coin that he got from the kid, which is the two-headed coin. And he's like, you know, tails you leave, heads you stay. And she's like, no. And he says, you know, it came up heads, how about it? And she's like, no, I'm going to go to the boat. And he says, all right, well, you know, he kisses her and says, you know, I'll see you later, and gives her the coin. And then when she realizes, she has that great moment where you see it come on her face, and then she just yells, hey! And you see the shot from outside the door through the rain as she's smiling, and, like, you know at that point she's going to wait and they're going to be together. But, like, that wouldn't work with a sexy, more, you know, composed woman. You know, she's a more excitable character than somebody like Lauren Bacall, so it works much better in that scene to end on that sort of, like, comedic, you know, moment.
Yeah, I mean, like, she, like, I don't know, certainly he probably could have done it, like, in his day, but Cary Grant, like, you know, kind of effortlessly has beautiful women falling all over him. In like a lot of movies, so I think like her kind of doe-eyed, almost like schoolgirl crush love on him, I think, you know, definitely makes her, to me certainly, more endearing than Rita Hayworth's character. I mean, you know,
well, Rita Hayworth looks great, but she's sort of a blank in the movie.
Yeah.
I mean, aside from her looks, you don't really see what Cary Grant fell in love with. You know, but that's okay, you know, because she's really not a huge part of the movie. But I like the fact that he's very civil with her. You know, he doesn't give it away. You know, he doesn't tell McPherson that they've had a pass together.
I just want to mention that, like, you know, we didn't talk about it earlier, but, like, McPherson, his first name is Bat. Is it Bat McPherson? I think that's pretty terrific.
Yeah, absolutely.
In, like, movies made in the 30s.
And McPherson has his own arc with not just the Flyers, but with Kid in particular, who he had a notorious history, you know, as being the pilot who parachuted out of his plane and let the mechanic die, and the mechanic ended up being Kid's brother. So everybody hated him, but, like, this is a story, not just a love story between Cary Grant and Jean Arthur. It is the story of Rita Hayworth's growth, because she left Cary Grant because he wanted to continue to be a Flyer. She began a relationship with McPherson, you know, but when she found out that McPherson was keeping something from her, she has that scene with Cary Grant where she's like, that's it, it's over, I'm leaving him. And then Cary Grant pours water on her because she's drunk. So he pours cold water on her and tells her to, you know, to snap out of it, and that she shouldn't be so concerned with the past and only with, you know, not in these words, but that they, you know, how they feel about each other in the now, in the here and now. And worry about her future instead, and that works, and she has that sort of growth, you know, where she is accepting of McPherson and decides that she doesn't need to know, you know, doesn't ever need to know what happened. But then he gets his redemption as well, you know, by by bringing Kit back at the end of the movie, and not leaving the aircraft to crash. And giving Kid the opportunity to say goodbye to his best friend instead of crashing an airplane.
Yeah. About one of those scenes that I remember thinking, like, when they first show up is, I mean, in that scene, you know, Kid is killed by a condor.
Right.
But one of the things I was...
That's why we got Jurassic Park. It's fucking condors.
Yes, so. Condors. one of the things I really thought about that I thought was kind of like odd is how there's a sequence earlier in the film when they're transporting nitroglycerin He's unable to make the thing, and because of the danger, he has to drop the nitroglycerin out of the plane. And all I could think about was, like, how condors are now, like, an endangered species. And, like, in this movie, they're blowing up condors with nitroglycerin.
Yeah.
All I could think about was Richard Attenborough's speech.
Damn you, John Hammond.
You should have... It wasn't just deforestation, it was also Cary Grant that contributed to, like, endangered populations of condors.
You know, I was reminded of Sorcerer while watching this because of that scene.
That's the first thing I thought of, too.
Yeah, like, so, it very Wages of Fear. But, you know, that's sort of like South American, like, middle of nowhere, like, jungle aesthetic that they're in.
You should have just taken planes, dumbasses. Hot air balloons, you'll be fine.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that Hawks uses two smaller side characters as, like, our entryway into the story. You know, so kind of like, you know, like, Kurosawa's Hidden Fortress, among other movies, the small characters of this are incredibly important at providing commentary on the events of the film and sort of guiding us with their reactions. You know, so it's Les and Joe who meet Bonnie, you know, and it takes a good, it's got to be at least 10 or 12 minutes before Cary Grant comes into the movie at all.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So.
There's a lot that goes on in it, but. Before he does show up, but yeah, you know, like I said earlier, that dialogue is kind of blisteringly paced, you know.
Yeah. The aerial photography is quite good. In fact, for the most part, aside from, like, some visible wires on, like, the, you know, the models that they're using for special effects, I thought the special effects were incredibly well done. And really not just for their day. Like, I kind of, you know, didn't think twice about it. Even, like, the crashes are pretty well executed.
Yeah, there's that second crash, I think, where it kind of comes inside. It crashes and then flips and rolls sideways a little bit. I remember thinking that looked like pretty realistically achieved, you know?
Yeah, and the pyrotechnic work where... McPherson's at the, you know, in the cockpit, and there's a fire, like, raging in front of him. Like, that looked practical to me. Like, that looked like the actor was, like, right there in the fire.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that was real.
Yeah, like, I mean, that seemed pretty dangerous. So, like, I was on the edge of my seat during that sequence. And it, you know, for as much as, like, dread is in this film, and, you know, like, just the overall mood that Hawks is able to achieve, you know, there's only two deaths in this movie, right? Or am I wrong? It's just the first death is Joe when he crashes, and then when Kid breaks his neck because of the condors.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Like, there's no other death. But you feel surrounded by...
Well, it's two deaths in the span of a week, though. You know?
Yeah, but, like, as a viewer... You feel surrounded by, or just engulfed in this dread the whole time. You know, like,
sure. Danger doesn't necessarily mean death, though. Danger can mean a lot of different things. So.
That's true. But it, like, I don't know. Like, I just, like, I feel like, I just feel like the mood, you know, if for as much comedy as in this movie, like, I feel like it's dealing with some pretty dark material. You know, and how these men, you know, define their masculinity and how they deal with the death of their, you know, their comrades, you know, and, you know, the idea of how to have a life outside of that when you're so committed and excited by the work that you're doing. I tell you, the other movie that came to mind as I was watching this was The Hurt Locker.
Okay, yeah, that's a pretty good example.
Yeah, because these guys live such a dangerous lifestyle, you know, and at any point could go down in flames, but they get a high off of it. They love it. You know, they could not do it if they wanted to. There's even that line where after Joe dies, We haven't talked about Dutchy at all, but Sig Ruman plays Dutchy, who is the owner of the establishment and the, I guess, the co-financier of the airline with Cary Grant. Mm-hmm. That's at least that's, you know, the way
owner,
it seems.
Right? Yes.
But like after Joe dies, Dutchy's like, I am not like you. I can't watch these kids die. And Grant says something to the effect of, you know, I feel the same way, but you know that kid would rather be dead there than not have his wings, essentially. You know, like, he'd rather be dead than not fly. So if I tell him he's not good enough, you know, that would be worse. Yeah. And that actually fuels the emotion, at least for me, it fuels the emotion that you feel when he has to ground the kid later.
Yeah.
So, so I don't know. I mean, I think
certainly, but
yeah, but I think a lot of these connections, like, really just like I said earlier, just really came together for me on the second viewing. So, if anybody out there watched this and they were just like, "Eh," you know, I would say give it another shot because there's so much more like to really like dig into.
Good point. Well, I've only watched it the once, and I quite enjoyed it immensely. So, it might be a while before my second viewing, but you know, it's something that's kind of occupied my thoughts. I only watched it yesterday, but it's kind of occupied my thoughts all morning.
Yeah. The only thing, I guess, and this is an artifact of its day, I guess, in the way that it treats the girls, but like, you know, the women in the film have to sort of conform their lifestyles to the men's lifestyle in order to be with the men. So that's a little bit problematic through the lens of today's like social acceptance.
Yeah.
And Cary Grant, like, and I think, I don't know, it's funny when he shakes like Jean Arthur and Rita Hayworth because like,
their shoulders and stuff.
He's so sort of flamboyant about the whole thing. He doesn't just like shake their shoulders. Like he's like jiggling his arms and stuff too. So, but yeah, like the idea that he sort of like manhandles these women a little bit, you know, that they're hysterical and he's the one who's right all the time. But you know, again, this was made in 1939, so things were a little bit different back then. You know. And by the way, speaking of 1939, the same year that Sky Captain and the World of Tomorrow takes place, so there's a connection from our previous episode to this one, and they're both dealing with pilots. But in 1939, what do you think the top three grossing movies were?
Was it this? Wizard of Oz?
Gone with the Wind and Wizard of Oz were number one and two, and this was number three.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah, so, like
that was pretty lucky. So, like, in maybe in an extra shot of Sky Captain, the theater is playing this.
I know, it should have been. Instead of King's Row, they should have been playing this one.
Well, they only had a couple screens in theaters back then.
They had tons of theaters back then, but the studios owned them. So... All right, cool. Well, anything else you want to talk about?
Can we talk about how, like, Jean Arthur shoots Cary Grant?
Oh, shit, yeah. That scene is hilarious. It's funny because in the scene right before that, she's like, I'm not going to tie you down. I'm going to be different than all the other women. That's another thing, like, as far as, like, their treatment of women. She's like, I'm going to be different. Don't worry. I'm the kind of girl that you're going to like. And in the very next scene, she's like, nope, I can't do it. And she grabs his gun. She's like, you can't go up in this plane, Cary Grant.
I like that, like, how after she shoots him, albeit accidentally, of course, like, how he, he's kind of like, oh, well, damn. Like, he's not like, he just shot me. He's just, you know, Supercar's like, well, I guess I can't fly. What do you think, Doc?
Well, hey, in all fairness to Cary Grant, You know, we just talked about two episodes ago, Hard Boiled, and Andy Lau gets shot in the back with a shotgun and still, like, beats up five guys before he realizes he's in pain. So maybe Cary Grant's in shock. We can give him the benefit of the doubt.
Tony Long, not Andy Lau.
Oh, yeah, Tony Long, sorry. Damn it. I have to go back and edit that out. Like,
I was in Pearl Affairs. You just picked the wrong guy.
You know I'm terrible with names. What's your name again?
Kid. Bat McPherson.
Bat McPherson. Actually, his original name's pretty good, too.
Yeah, it's not bad. All right, how about you? Anything else?
No, were you done with the shooting thing?
What else did you say? I just wanted to commiserate.
I love the idea that Cary Grant, like, gets shot in the left shoulder, so he's got his left arm in a sling, and the Les character, who's played by Alan Jocelyn, gets his arm broken in a fight earlier in the movie, his right arm, so he's got his right arm in a sling. And at the end, they decide to go up together and pilot the ship as one because they each have one good arm. And all I could think of was, like, a Pacific Rim where they're, like, you know, like, both controlling the robot together. Like, Cary Grant and Alan are up there, like, one arm in it. Like,
maybe the version I saw was different, but you didn't realize that those bi-wings, like, transform into robots?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. I guess mine was the uncut edition.
That's the Sky Captain version.
Yeah. All right.
But yeah, it was good. It was good. Very good pick.
For the listeners out there.
Wait, say that again?
How did you watch the film? So that people know where they can take a look at it.
Well, it's available on Amazon to rent. But I picked up the brand new Criterion Blu-ray.
Okay. Yeah. I guess I was at the flea market about a week ago, and I just blind bought it on, like, an old school DVD.
Yeah, the Columbia Pictures DVD?
Yep.
Yeah.
So I didn't even know that there was a Criterion for it, but I guess that makes the availability of it a lot easier than, like, finding, like, this out-of-print DVD that I picked up.
Yeah, and the artwork on the front of the Criterion is like Cary Grant in that horrible sombrero.
Nice.
Yeah, it's sweet.
I think it's time for an upgrade. do you have anything notes, any other notes or anything before we wrap this thing up?
No, I feel good about this.
Yeah.
I made it through without falling asleep, so I think we're good.
Good talk. You seem like you have more energy now than you did at the beginning.
I can't wait to take a fucking nap, man. I'm telling you.
Let's keep this going for another 30 minutes or so.
Hey, if you have something you want to say, go for it, man. I can do it. I can do it. I can do it like Cary Grant taking a 6-hour flight with just a cup of coffee.
Okay. Yeah. Cup of coffee only.
Yep. He might have had a half sandwich.
Can you do it with a bullet in your shoulder?
I hope I never find out.
Plus. Right.
If I ever get shot in the shoulder, there's going to be tears. I guarantee it.
Oh, yeah?
So, okay. I'm not...
Well, I mean, Cary Grant cries, too. Just not from a bullet.
No, from sorrow over his friend. That's the second great emotional point in the movie for him. So... Good thing Jean Arthur was there to wipe away his tears and shoot him.
Yeah, she really took his mind off of things.
Sweet. All right, well, for all the listeners out there who enjoyed this one, awesome. Our next episode, we're going to be talking about John Schlesinger's Marathon Man, starring Dustin Hoffman. So you can watch that and get prepared for the next episode. And for our 25th episode after that, we're going to be doing something special. So we'll tell you about that maybe next week.
Yeah, okay.
But, you know, thank you, Cesar. Where can people find you on the internet?
Of course, you can find me at filmsmash.com, as well as Twitter, @JuniorBijo.
Awesome. And you can find me at Setting the Frame, and of course on our Facebook Celluloid Jelly message board page / catch all for everything that we do. So until next time, have a great day, watch some good movies, and give us a shout out. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks everyone. Bye.
Celluloid Jelly was recorded using Google Hangouts, mixed using Apple's GarageBand software, and hosted by Podbean. For any inquiries related to Celluloid Jelly, please email settingtheframe@gmail.com.